Governor Steve Sisolak signed a new law a few weeks ago providing free tuition to Indigenous college students in Nevada. Another law forbids racially offensive mascots in schools. That signing led Stacy Montooth, head of the Nevada Indian Commission, to say there has never been a better time to be Indigenous and live in the state of Nevada. But the history of Indigenous people and elementary education in this state is not a pleasant one. In the third podcast of our series, Native Nevada, we look at Indigenous people and elementary education in the state.
Every morning I see the sunrise. I always get an opportunity to reflect on the path I took to get here.
That's Lance West, principal of Shears Elementary School on the Walker River Paiute Reservation.
The students, when they get off the bus and I see them all line up 3 feet apart, standing there waiting for us to go through the gates into our campus. I see that was me. That was, you know, each one of those little ones, I see a little boy, it reminds me of myself.
Shears is located about 90 minutes southeast of Reno in Mineral County. That's where Lance was raised, too, although he's an enrolled member of the Pyramid Lake Paiute tribe.
Knowing that those same students in front of me will be of importance and value and in some career, because all of my relatives I sat there growing up with, a lot of them have done very well for themselves. And knowing that these children, even with not all the resources available like they should be and services, but what we have, we make work. And it's just nice to be, to know that I'm going to be part of their life in some form.
This is Native Nevada, KNPR's podcast about the Indigenous peoples in the region now known as the U.S. state of Nevada. I'm your host, Richard Boland. In this episode, we look at elementary education, how it's failed Native students, and what some Native adults are doing to turn that around.
Hello, my name is Ferdina Dry Romero. Before we begin, I would like to acknowledge the 27 bands and colonies throughout Nevada. Each one is very unique, exercise their sovereignty of being a nation within the United States. And so today, you know, while I'm speaking, I'm acknowledging the traditional homelands of the Numa, the Nuu, the Washishu, and the Nui. The lands continue to be a gathering place for the Indigenous people, and we recognize that they have deep connection to these places. So I do want to extend their appreciation for the opportunity to live and to learn on these territories of the Indigenous peoples. I myself am Nuu and a Southern Paiute from the Kaibab Band of Paiute and from the Moapa Band of Paiutes in Southern Nevada.
Ferdina, or Dina as she's known to friends, is not only Nevada's top Native education official, she's the only one. Ferdina is the program's professional for Indian education in the Office of Inclusive Education. In that role, she bears the brunt of the many challenges facing Native communities, educators, and students in the state.
There's great diversity among all the four different tribal groups and their languages, their cultures, their histories, their governments. So likewise, the challenges vary from tribal community to tribal community. The national trends indicate that there is a higher absenteeism, a higher discipline, incidents, there's higher suspension and expulsion rates for Native American students. And our performance data for Native Americans shows that the graduation rates and the academic outcomes lag behind the state averages.
Here's an example of what Ferdina is referring to. In the most recent state data, K through 12 American Indian and Alaska Native students had a chronic absenteeism rate of 24.5%. That's compared to the 19% average among all students. 74% of American Indian and Alaska Native students graduated, compared to 84% of students overall. Why?
The research and the researchers actually indicate that there is often an omission, an inaccurate narrative, and stereotypes that really do fill the bases on these Native communities at a larger community scale. So, you know, for Native students, not only do they face the admissions of their identities and their histories or cultures and their languages in a school setting, they also face harmful presentation of information in text, materials, and holiday celebrations. Researchers found that disparities between cultural values and patterns of communication of the home and the school really do undermine children's enthusiasm for learning.
Ferdina is talking about what exists today, but there's a long history of this disparity, dating back to contact between colonial settlers and indigenous peoples.
We really also acknowledge the much needed work that we still need to do to continue to address the challenges known and unknown.
So this used to be a dark, nifty basement, and it has the third vault.
That's Bobby Rader, the museum director of the Stewart Indian School Cultural Center and Museum in Carson City.
The Stewart Indian School was created in 1890 by the federal government, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and operated for 90 years, from 1890 to 1980. It was originally intended to assimilate and teach Great Basin Native children, the local Nevada children that were from the Nevada tribes. There are 27 bands, tribes, and colonies in Nevada.
Stewart is one of hundreds of similar schools set up by the federal government.
And eventually it grew to accept students from, we think, over 200 tribes in the western states. It was intended to assimilate Native children, and it goes back to the treaties that the federal government signed with the tribes and really was an attempt to get their land. And in the treaties, they promised to educate Native children. So the way they chose to do that was in a very harsh military school-like environment. And they intended to ultimately really destroy Native culture was the ultimate underlying intention, although not their stated intention. So the way they chose to do that was to forcibly remove children from their Native families. Some of our children were as young as four. Sometimes they would just kidnap children from the road and bring them to the school, and their parents didn't know where they were, what had happened to them, and none of them spoke English. So it was very hard for them to find out what happened to their children.
Once in school custody, Native children were subjected to forced immersion in Euro-American culture.
Stewart is only one of hundreds of these types of boarding schools run by the federal government across the country in many states.
They were taught to be ashamed of their languages and cultural traditions.
The idea was to take them far away from their families and their Native influence and their tribal influence.
They were taught English.
Forcibly teach them to learn English.
And vocational skills.
They were taught how to do certain jobs, and they worked on the school grounds
and did all the cooking,
the cleaning,
laundry,
gardening,
and animal care,
making their own clothing, making their own shoes.
They even built some of the structures that are still on the museum grounds today.
They did all of the work of the school.
Their Native clothes and hair were replaced with European uniforms and haircuts, and they were punished for speaking their Native languages. The idea was to purge, to erase their true identities, much in the same way authentic Native history has been erased from U.S. history.
The allotment policy, where they forced the Native families to live on land and own a piece of land, which was not their tribal tradition, is tied to the boarding school and the assimilation policy. And so we do identify that particular policy as genocide, and it does meet the definition of the United Nations. It specifically says in the definition that taking children away from their culture is cultural genocide.
Acts intended to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group as such. With those words, which passed the General Assembly in 1948, the United Nations defined genocide.
Today's program is dedicated to the memory of Raphael Lemkin, who coined the term genocide.
For Lemkin, genocide can take many forms. Killing people is one of them. Forbidding them to, say, study their language is another. Not enabling them to affiliate with one or to choose to affiliate with one another as a group is another.
Now I've made a name for this crime. Is it not strange that in tens of thousands of years there's been no name for so monstrous a thing? Genocide. Genos, the Greek for race, nation, tribe. Kaidere, the Latin to kill. genocide.
What happened during the boarding school period still affects Native families today. There is not one Native family that is not connected to a boarding school story. Not one. Think about the fact that a child as young as 4 is raised in an institution and not in a family, and then they stay at that school and leave, start their own family. They have no clue how to be a parent. They've never been loved or parented, and they don't know how to raise a family. Which happened often at these schools in the beginning years, they were abused in some way. That started a cycle of abuse that they have continued on. But not only that, there are studies that show that the intergenerational trauma is carried over in their DNA.
But amidst the trauma, there was something powerful happening at Stewart. Students bonded. They formed communities that transcended tribal affiliations. They advocated for themselves and for each other.
For instance, John Dressler, who was a local Washoe student here, he became the first student body president at Stewart. He realized that a number of his fellow students were getting sick a lot, and he investigated and found that the dining hall was not cooking the meat to the proper temperature, and it was causing illness. So he went to the superintendent and demanded that they cook the food better. And another case of advocating happened when the superintendent, sometime in the 70s, wanted to tear down the auditorium here at Stewart. It's a beautiful auditorium, and it was a place that they went to graduate, to watch plays, to watch movies. So they protested when the superintendent wanted to tear the building down, and they won. It's still here.
So they started in 1920. Our building was built in 1923. It's the first of the stone buildings. This would have been next, is 1925. And then they built the superintendent's cottage over there, the two dorms over there, the auditorium's over there. So we now have 65 buildings on 110 acres that are all built by the students. They're still standing.
Over time, Bobby says reforms improved life at Stewart. By the 1960s, it had become more like a high school, one that Native children wanted to attend in order to escape the rampant racism in public schools. Some of the 20 living Stewart alumni on the museum's advisory board have fond memories of going there in the 70s and 80s. We heard about some of the challenges that Native K through 12 students face today, and how those challenges can be traced back to the policies and practices used at U.S. Indian boarding schools, such as in Stewart and Carson City. Stewart epitomizes the long history of Native families and tribes being cut off from their children's education. It created an enduring lack of trust in public education among Natives. It disrupted the flow of Native education from one generation to the next, and it set a standard of erasure and misrepresentation of Native culture and history in textbooks and curricula.
All right, I'm Mercedes Krause. I'm a mother of 3. I was born and raised in Las Vegas, but I'm a dual citizen of the Oglala Lakota Nation. I've taught in the Clark County School District for about 15 years, raised, as I said, my 3 children in the CCSD. But a lot of the same problems still exist, and it's very frustrating. We don't have accurate data. I haven't seen this year's legislative report, but in the 2019 legislative report, Nevada Ready, they had the achievement data of all other students, but not Native American students, completely inequitable. Teachers are in need of professional development so that, you know, when they're given curriculum or books that are inaccurate, they'll be able to have that lens so that they can make good choices for educating their students.
The issues that Mercedes touches on, curricula, data, professional development, are among those that inspired the formation of a nonprofit called Indigenous Educators Empowerment, or IEE, in 2018. Lance West, the principal of Shears Elementary School, who we heard from earlier, started IEE to address problems that educators like he and Mercedes were seeing firsthand. Their aim is to spark positive change through peer support across the state of Nevada, by Natives, for Natives.
Part of our mission is to recruit and retain highly qualified indigenous teachers. We are also looking at getting achievement data, accurate achievement data, so our tribes and our urban communities can make good decisions to support our future generations.
Currently, the top issue when it comes to equity or inequities that exist within our districts and state related to Native American students is the lack of sharing of achievement data. It's a major challenge that we're seeing here in terms of the relationship between the Walker River Paiute tribe and the two school districts that serve their students, our students, Mineral County School District and Lyon County School District.
Support them and support all of our people.
This is related to the achievement gap that Ferdina Dreyer-Romero described earlier. Lance sees Native kids falling through the cracks, in part, because tribal nations aren't aware of what's going on with their students. Privacy rules prevent public agencies from sharing individual student data with the tribes. If school officials did share such information with tribes, Lance believes, then tribal education coordinators could review it and address problems, get families involved, and offer counseling or tutoring.
A hypothetical scenario would be you have a senior in high school. This student is a tribal member of the Walker River Paiute tribe. And surprisingly, it's discovered the second semester of his senior year that he is short high school credits. Let's say he's short 6 credits. You can't make up 6 credits in one semester. So the first concern is, where were the conversations between him and his counselor? Where were the conversations and meetings between the student and his parents or her parents and the site administrator with the counselor? Even more so, where was the communication when the student was failing, say, as a freshman, Algebra 1, failing both first and second semester, between the teacher and the parents? Well, where is the communication and outreach from the parents to the Walker River Paiute Tribe's education department? None of that occurred. None of that occurred.
IEE wants to help bridge these gaps. Lance has been meeting every other week with Stacy Montooth, the executive director of the Nevada Indian Commission, which has an Indian Education Advisory Committee. That committee's most recent strategic plan from 2009 lists many of the same goals as IEE. Lance hopes they can work together to reach them. Ferdina also points out that there is a formal mechanism in place for facilitating cooperation between Native nations and school districts. Actually, it's part of her job.
The creation of my position, the Education Program Professional, was enacted in 1997 through AB 266. This gave the state the opportunity to fund a position whose sole focus would be on collaborating with the tribes and organizations throughout Nevada to ensure that student achievement for Native American students.
Members of Congress from both parties have come together to revise our national education law, a Christmas miracle, a bipartisan bill signing right here. So,
in 2015, President Obama signed the Every Student Succeeds Act, which broadly aims at equal opportunity for all kids.
Today, I'm proud to sign a law that's going to make sure that every student is prepared to succeed in the 21st century.
Ferdina says the law also created a formal consultation process between tribal representatives and local agencies that serve American Indian and Alaska Native student populations. In order for that to happen, a school district and a tribe whose students the district serves have to come to an agreement formalized in a Memorandum of Understanding, or MOU. Currently, Ferdina says there are 4 such MOUs.
So those school districts who are in consultation with the tribes in their school districts are Churchill County School District, the Clark County, Elko County School District, and Washoe County School District. You know, that's just one example of the federal law that talks about the consultation process.
In addition, there's the Johnson-O'Malley Act of 1934, the federal funding program for education, medical care, and other services for Native Americans. And there's Title VI, Part A of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which is meant to ensure that Native American children's educational needs are met. Ferdina points out that any school district that wants to receive more than $40,000 in Title VI funding has to consult with the tribes whose children it serves. Her office also gets a federal Native Youth Community Project grant. That NYCP grant, as she calls it, funds programs to prepare students in 7th through 12th grade for college and career.
And the grant provides like funding to support a college and career coach to work within the schools, a community-based instructor to work within the troubled communities, to implement activities to improve student academic performance. And these activities include tutoring, summer programs, conferences that are designed to engage students, and guided visits to colleges. The grant also proposes to have like more of a community collaborative events to support education.
Ferdina says Urington High School, which serves students from the Urington Paiute Tribe and the Waka River Paiute Tribe, is one example of how an NYCP program can make a difference.
We saw in one school, I want to talk about one in particular, you know, this project alone has been successful in showing a decrease in discipline issues. It's shown an increase in graduation rates, and in this one specific location, the data collected saw a pronounced decrease in discipline actions from literally 237 the previous year to 57 most recently. And this same site also saw a decrease in the truancy from an average of 45% to, you know, 5%. And this was just one example, but it gives us hope that these are efforts that can change practices in schools that can better have better results.
The NYCP grant also pays for a program run by our own assistant producer for this broadcast, Avery Wyatt. It's a program broadcast on social media called Amplified Nevada Native Youth. Meanwhile, in Reno, another program is addressing some of the cultural issues identified by IEE and the state's Indian Education Advisory Committee.
Hauma, ne Stacy Burns Minania, ne Onaraka, ne Retukwaitu, ne Washu, ne Kovawaitu Kimara, ne Pasiapa Nobigayu. Ipia Brenda Burns Nanian, Ina Dwayne Rambo Tom Nanian, Imoa Bertina Dick Burns Nanian, Gapa. Ihutsi Doa Rambo Tom Nanian, I Gunu William Rambo Jr. Nanian, Agapa. Ne Watsukwehu Duamu Bigayu, Ikuma Anthony Hernandez Nanian. I greeted you. I said, how are you? And then I let you know what my name was. I did tell you my band's a Paiute. So I am of the Onarakat, so that means the Salt Eater Band from Colville, California. I'm also of the Ururugwaitu, which is the Hot Water Band of Benton Paiute Tribe, California. And I also let you know that my lineage also goes to the Washoe Tribe. And then from there, I let you know who my mother was, my father, my maternal grandmother, my paternal grandparents. And then I let you know I have 5 children and who my husband is, and he's Anthony Hernandez.
Stacy is the coordinator of the Language and Culture Program for the Reno Sparks Indian Colony. She teaches Paiute language classes in her local tribal community and supports the Paiute language program in the Washoe County School District. 3 high schools currently offer Paiute courses as a world language option. Here's an example of how Stacy approaches her classes.
Well, why even learn an indigenous language? So I give them a story of our plants. I say, well, many of our plants and indigenous things that were here were renamed. So I always take rabbit brush. And I say, rabbit brush, there's a stigma attached to it. Ooh, I'm allergic. Every spring and fall, it blooms and, you know, my allergies are just awful. I dread that plant. So I say, well, I'm going to teach you a different word, and it's its original name. It's called Sigupi. Sigupi is what we call rabbit brush in our Paiute language. So I'm also going to gift you that tech, that traditional ecological knowledge that comes with Sigupi. You take those little blooms in the top, those flowers, you boil them and make a tea. You consume the tea strain it, and it is acts as an antibiotic. And then the most beautiful part as well is every fall it blooms this big, beautiful, bright yellow. And that's an indicator to a lot of our indigenous people that it is time to go pick our pine nuts. So many of us who fear it, please don't fear it based off of, you know, its renaming and its new stigma attached to it.
Stacy shares Lance and Mercedes' concerns about inaccurate or inadequate information in curriculum and about the lack of professional development for non-natives teaching Native history.
So think about it as one of the most traumatic histories, one of the most traumatic events that happen in your life, that it's unfolded in front of a whole class. When my student comes home asking about certain traumatic things have happened within our Native American history, I have to answer those questions. I have to de-escalate my child. I have to bring my child back from the brink of tears, because you're not just teaching history books. You're teaching a trauma that is only a generation away from my child. You're teaching a trauma that I have seen in my grandmother's eyes. I have witnessed stories. I have seen the hurt and felt the anger. And I've felt so much from my grandmother, my mo'a, in regards to the Indian boarding schools. I had to feel that hurt. I had to see those tears. I had to make sure that I don't pass those on to my child. It's very difficult. It's a very difficult task. And, you know, I myself as a parent, I don't want to have to de-escalate my child after your lesson.
Lance sees non-Native teachers fall into another trap when educating Native students.
The biggest piece of advice is lose a Superman mentality. Don't come in wanting to save our people.
In developing her curriculum, Stacy works closely with tribal elders, who she describes as the PhDs, the doctors, and scientists of Indigenous language and culture, and the backbone of her program.
Having an elder come into your room is one of the most special, most beautiful things you can think of, as far as validating your language and culture to your students. There is just this regalness that our elders have and possess, and they are able to conduct themselves in such a respectful manner that I strive to be just like my elders.
Stacy encourages other communities to seek out local Native nations and to work with them to institute programs like hers. It's hard work, she says, requiring the cooperation of the state, school districts, and tribes, but it's worth the trouble because the positive impact it has in Native children's lives.
It takes a lot of community to create a programming like this. But first and foremost, it took the students, the student body, to rally together and let their school know, this is what we want as Native students. These Native students now feel this sense of belonging to the school, and it validates everything that their family has really told them, has taught them, and many of them shine within these programs because it's their program. It feels like it's a sense of them.
A sense of belonging to family and community. What Stacy is describing is healing, healing the wounds of cultural genocide.
Growing up as a young Native person, you know, you're not given material things. You know, as a young Native person, I grew up very poor from what I thought. I didn't have a phone, or I didn't have much as far as material goes. But I had my grandmother, and I didn't realize it then, but I was very rich in culture. Young Native youth don't realize the riches and the wealth that is embedded in them. In our society, we're valued, or some people are valued by your material, your possessions, your lands, which is a foreign concept, but we don't own the land. When I was younger, I had tradition. I had culture, I had language.
Where once she saw a deficit, now she sees a gift. What if all of Nevada's children could see Native culture this way? You've been listening to Native Nevada, KNPR's podcast about Indigenous peoples in the region now known as the U.S. state of Nevada. This production is made possible in part by a grant from the San Manuel Band of Mission Indians. Producers are Heidi Kaiser and Joe Shaneman. Assistant producers are Jarrett Work and Avery Wyatt. Sound design is by Regina Revazova of Open Conversation. Special thanks to the group Kalpuli Tata Loco, with drummer Joe Bab Mendez for sharing audio of their dance at Niu Art. We also thank Christina Thomas for letting us use one of her songs, Eagle Mountain, in this episode. You can find more episodes of Native Nevada wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm your host, Richard Boland. Thanks for listening.